Well, we've been gone for a while.
Yeah, life got busy.
But that's just how it goes when you don't get paid by your hobbies.
Yeah.
They go on the back burner.
Yep. Ain't that the truth?
I mean, I really don't have anything to talk about. Nothing really new has happened to me. I've just been busy helping other people do other things.
Mm-hmm. I remember the one story at least, though, because it was really funny. Okay, so remember I sent you that video of that, like, weird, ominous, middle of nowhere, in a field, roller coaster?
Yeah.
So we were, like, shovel testing that field, and I, like, my coworker had stopped, like, just outside of it, because that's where their next test was supposed to be. And I walked up to them, and was like, so I think I need to walk around it, because I think if I walk through it, I will be cursed, I think something lives in there, and it's the owner of it, and if I walk through, I will have invaded its space, and, like, I don't think I can do that. And they were like, yeah, no, I agree. Like, for sure, go around. Because you could totally walk through. It wasn't, like, a safety concern to walk through it. It felt wrong to do. And then the other person who, like, works for this, because we were doing contract work for another company, they don't work for us. We don't really know them, right?
Yeah.
They didn't hear us talk about this. They didn't stop to also say the same thing. They just, like, walked up and then walked all the way around the outside.
That's funny. Did they see roller coaster?
No, I hadn't done it yet. Okay. I was still standing there, just, you know, like, looking at it.
Yeah.
You know, hands on hips, looking at it. And they walked all the way around, like, no questions asked, like, no pause of thought, like, nope, we don't go through that. Oh my goodness, though. But what was really funny is my hat fits real good on my head. Like, I can wear it on, like, wind boats, you know, yeah.
It won't come off.
The fan boats. Mm-hmm. In, like, Florida, it won't come off. Like, sticks to my head. Perfect fit. Really upset.
See, I got a weird shaped head. Hats don't fit on me.
It's just that hat. No other hat has ever fit me this way. They don't sell this hat anymore. It's really, really upsetting.
Well, I think the tell is I can't wear headbands either. They slip right off the back.
I think you just said you got a real round
head.
They're
here.
Right. You don't have any flat surface. Just all round.
Yeah. You wish I could get hats to fit me.
You were held too much as a baby. Somebody cared.
I didn't get stuck in the birth
canal. No, that's true. No, you didn't even get the opportunity.
No.
It's cut right out. No, but my hat, it was not a windy day either. This is also important. Singular gust of wind came and, like, blew that thing off and then towards, like, the inside of the
thing. It was trying to get you in.
And I, like, had to run to get it so I didn't have to enter. And I was like, no, 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 no.
They're calling for you.
That's the story. That's all I got.
That's a pretty good one. No, I don't think anything particularly haunting has happened to me lately. Sadly, nothing really ever does.
You don't do too much.
No, I don't. I just sit in my house.
I'll go first.
It's then. A good one. Okay.
Okay. My story is about Bellstar. My sources are the U.S. Census and Wikipedia. I tried to use the Encyclopedia Britannica. It did not have accurate information when I checked it against the federal documents.
Poopy.
So Myra Maybelle Shirley, who went by May, was born most likely in Jasper County, Missouri, near Carthage on February 5th, 1848, to Elizabeth and John Shirley. As I was saying earlier, the official biographies I found online had both different birth name and birthplace for her. And I don't know why, again, because all of the government documents are consistent with her name and her birth date and place and all that. It's just, like, these biographies used a bad source.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the bad source was. So she was, she's the third living child of seven surviving children from Elizabeth. I just don't know if there were more children or not, like, just because there's seven on the census doesn't mean some lived and died between then, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if her father had more children or not, because Elizabeth was his third wife. So, who knows? But I know she's definitely third living of seven.
Yeah.
From Elizabeth. So her father, John, was the black sheep of a wealthy Virginia family, and he had moved west, first to Indiana, where he married and divorced twice, and then he eventually moves to Missouri. I think he marries Elizabeth while also in Indiana. Elizabeth went by Eliza Hatfield, was related to the Hatfields and the
Hatfields McCoys. I was going to say, of the like, Hatfield and McCoys?
Yeah, but, like distant from the ones that did the feuding.
Yeah.
anyway, she was his third wife, and he was 20 years younger than him, which is a bit more reasonable being a third wife. I didn't know that originally, and I was like, that's a big age gap. What is happening here? But if he's married three times.
Well, also, what year was it?
She was born in 1848. Gaps weren't as weird then. And she was like...
I was going to say, yeah.
She was a full adult by then, too.
At least she wasn't a youth.
Yeah.
12 years old.
She was a young adult, but she was... It wasn't. She was married off when she was 14.
Yeah, like, I think the girl in my story had kids in, like, her early 20s or mm-hmm. something like that, so...
So hers was... It was not an abnormal experience for the time. When she was very young, her father worked in... is a farmer raising wheat, corn, hogs, and horses on the family farm near Carthage, Missouri, where she's supposed to be born, I think. Makes the most sense.
Yeah.
And by the time she was 12, the Shirley family had sold their farm and moved into Carthage proper. They had bought a livery stable and a blacksmith shop on the town square, and John worked as a hotel keeper. So they, like, you know, upped their social standings, which makes sense because he came from a wealthy family. I assume he then knew how to do what he needed to do to climb.
Yeah.
Even if he didn't necessarily have funds from them, because I don't know if he did.
I mean, he got divorced twice. I doubt they gave him
anything. Yeah, he's disowned.
Anything that he had, they weren't giving him anything else.
So, May was technically classically educated and knew to play the piano. She graduated from the Carthage Female Academy, which is a private institution her father helped form. Though her attendance was supposedly irregular, and at least one of her teachers considered her wild. which I can, you know, based on, I'm telling you a story about her for a reason, it's probably true that she's a little bit wild. Her eldest brother, John Allison M. Shirley, who went by Bud, joined the Bushwhackers, who are Confederate sympathizing guerrillas, you know, like Jesse James or Bloody Billy Anderson. And he joined at the start of the Civil War. He was killed in 1864 by Union troops, so he made it through a lot of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Bud's death devastated his father, and in addition to Bud's death, the war had left his businesses ruined by theft and destruction of property. So he sold what he had left, loaded the family in two Conestoga wagons, and headed to Texas. It is said that May drove one of the wagons, because she would have been, I think, the oldest child at home by then, because she had an older sister, but she's out of the house pre-Civil War already, so it would make sense that she's the other driver.
Yeah.
Because she had young siblings, too, so. In 1866, May marries James C. Reed, and a year later they had their first child, Rosie Lee. She went by Pearl. May was known for having a strong sense of style. She almost exclusively rode side saddle, not for like lady reasons, but to prove how good she of a horseman she was, that she could do all these things side saddle, basically. Uh-huh. And she would do it wearing a black velvet riding habit with a plumed hat. She carried two pistols that she was known for being a crack shot with, and she wore a cartridge belt around her hips.
So
it's like from a distance, I think you knew who she was.
That's my goal in life.
I think she had a firm sense of self. So at some point after their marriage, Reed turns to crime as his profession.
Woohoo!
And he becomes wanted for murder in Arkansas. So the family all moves out to California in 1871. And this is when they have their second child, James Edwin, went by Eddie. They are not in California long and move back to Texas, where Reed becomes involved with a number of gangs. He's involved with the James and younger gangs, as well as has connections with the Star Clan, which, from what I found, I think they are a Cherokee Indian family who were notorious for whiskey, cattle, and horse thieves, but I believe they were like an organized crime family. Like, they weren't a gang, they were an organized crime family.
Hmm.
So, let's see. In 1874, a warrant was issued for May's arrest for participating in a stagecoach robbery that was conducted by her husband and some others. Though nothing seems to have come of the warrant. And when I was reading this, they're like, and there was no evidence that she was there. And I was like, I think she at least knew what was happening, which would make you, like, semi-complicit at least. Based on everything else we're going to read later, she knew what her husband was doing.
Yeah, she knew it wasn't a criminal.
Yeah. It wasn't a secret job situation. He wasn't doing it on the sly. And then in August 1874, Reed was killed. He was shot. That's how all these gang people die. In 1880, May marries Sam Starr, a Cherokee man of the Starr clan.
Yeah.
And moves to Indian Territory, modern-day Oklahoma. Around this time, she's officially using, like, Belle as, like, her primary name instead of May.
Uh-huh.
So now she's Belle Starr.
That's pretty cool.
As she is now married into the Starr clan, she learns about organized crime. She learns to organize planted fence for rustlers, horse thieves, and bootleggers. She also harbors people when necessary from the law. She was good at the work and made enough money to successfully bribe many of her colleagues free when they were caught by the law.
Nice.
In 1883, Belle and Sam were arrested by Bass Reeves, who was the first black U.S. Marshal west of the Mississippi. He was cool. He apparently arrested 3,000 people and only ever killed 14 of them in self-defense. I wish there was more on him. Maybe I'll, like, look him up one day.
I was gonna say, there probably is.
He doesn't seem like a good candidate for the podcast, but, like, he seems worth learning about.
Yeah.
I think there should be media on him out there, like, that people are producing, like, you know, a fun movie or a documentary. Mm-hmm. He seems neat.
There might be, like, a book or something on him, I'm sure.
Reeves described Belle as a loud and unruly prisoner. They were accused of horse theft. They were tried by the hanging judge, Isaac Parker, from Fort Smith, Arkansas. She was found guilty, as was Sam. And I think they both were sentenced to serve 9 months. And she served this in the Detroit House of Corrections in Detroit, Michigan, where she was apparently a model prisoner. Which makes sense that while she's captured, she's being, like, sassy as heck. And then once she's there, she's like, well, I'm here.
Yep.
We might as well make this easier on everybody.
Maybe I can get out early.
Right? Sam, on the other hand, was apparently incorrigible and decided hard labor. And I'm also thinking that had to do with the fact that he was not white.
Yeah, I was going to say.
As to why he was assigned hard labor. In 1886, she was charged with theft a second time, but was not convicted. In December 1886, so same year, Sam was involved in a gunfight with law officer Frank West, his cousin. Both men died in the fight, which ended the happiest relationship of Belle's life. Very sad. Aww. This apparently was her favorite husband.
Dang.
She does seem to come into her own while married to him. After Sam's death, Belle was connected to a series of men, including Jack Spaniard, Jim French, and Blue Duck. That's not his first and last name. That's just
his
Cherokee man. She married Jim July.
Jim July. Yeah.
He was 15 years younger than she was. So she's a cougar now.
Be that way sometimes.
February 3rd. I mean, when you're on your third husband.
Yeah.
Why not?
I mean, her parents were 20 years apart, weren't they?
Yeah. So, you know, just following in her father's footsteps, right? February 3rd, 1889, Belle was riding home from a neighbor's house. Okay. Word to her death. We know for sure, February 3rd, 1889, Belle dies.
Okay.
We don't quite know how. That is contested. There's more than one story.
Dun, dun, dun.
So one is, Belle was riding home from a neighbor's house when she was ambushed. She was shot and fell from her horse and then shot a second time while on the ground to assure that she was dead.
Man.
She had wounds to her back, neck, shoulder, and face from a shotgun. And, like, some legends about her like to say it was her own shotgun, mm-hmm. even though she's known for carrying pistols, so I don't know why it's so exciting that it was her own shotgun. You didn't even get the gun right for your fun legend, guys.
They never do.
And then the second version of her death, like, the second primary version of her death, is told by Frank Pistol Pete Eaton. According to Pistol Pete, That's what we'll call him now, because why would you not?
Well, that's his name.
Belle had been to a dance when an intoxicated Edgar J. Watson, one of Belle's sharecroppers, approached her for a dance and was rejected. He then followed her home when she left that night, and when she stopped to give her horse water, he shot and killed her. And according to Pistol Pete, Watson was then arrested, tried, and hanged for her murder. However, that did not happen to Watson. So we have to know at least part of Pistol Pete's story is not true. So her murder is technically classified as unsolved. Her husband, her children, and Watson were all actual suspects. Watson was a real suspect.
Okay.
In her murder, though no one was actually convicted.
I'm surprised they're even looking into it.
I think she was, like, just upstanding enough.
Yeah.
That they're like, a woman has been murdered on her horse, you know? So her son is said to have motive for two reasons. One, he was always jealous of how much more she liked Pearl. Okay. And two, that he had recently been beaten by Belle for having mistreated her horse. He was an adult man.
I was going to say, wait a minute.
Doesn't mean that he wasn't beaten by his mother, but he was an adult. So those would be his motives. And the only reason either of those would make sense is he was also mentally unstable.
Yeah, I don't...
So Edgar Watson's possible motive would be that he was wanted for murder in Florida. Belle did know this, and he may have feared that she was going to turn him in for whatever reason, because he might have just been doing a bad job at being... he was a hired person for her. And maybe he was not doing a great job, and he was scared that she was going to tell on him, and that's why he would kill her.
Yeah.
And he was even he was tried for the murder, but acquitted. That's how much they thought it was him out of everybody else. He was the only one who, went that far, was actually arrested for anything. But her death is considered unsolved. I don't think it ever really will be unless somebody finds a letter.
Yeah. I did it.
Anyway, we're going to jump to her children. I was going to end the story there because she died. But then her children were a little bit interesting.
Okay.
So in 1889, Eddie was convicted of horse theft and receiving stolen property, so working as a fence. He was sent to prison in Columbus, Ohio. So Pearl, his older sister, became a prostitute to raise funds for Eddie's release, eventually earning enough to hire a defense team which secured a presidential pardon for him in 1893.
Dang.
And that was like the end on the Wikipedia page about her children, basically.
I mean, sorry, Sadie, but I'm not doing that for you.
No. And then I was like, hold on.
I'll start a GoFundMe, I guess.
if she managed to raise that much money through that occupation, there has to be more information on her. Right? So I searched her up and got, the rest of the kids' stories. Oh, other than, his story finishes. Let me finish his story quick. So after he's released, he becomes a deputy for Fort Smith, kills the Crittenden brothers in 1895, and is eventually shot and killed in Claremore, Oklahoma in 1896. I assume is working as a deputy. He just wasn't very good at it. That's the end of his story. Pearl, however, continued her occupation, because clearly she's very good what she does.
Making that money.
And I was like, there's no way she's just, a prostitute. Mm-hmm. There's no way she's doing the sex work. And I was right, because she opens a number
she's
of brothels.
She's a PIMP.
Yeah. She's a madame, for your information.
A PIMP.
So Pearl, who goes by Pearl Star, continues to work in the sex industry, right? Operating several bordellos in Van Buren and Fort Smith, Arkansas from the 1890s until World War I.
Wow.
Which feels weird that somebody's doing something from then to then. I know people have to live over that time period, but it feels wrong. It's like, nope, all of the people who lived in the 1800s died in 1900.
Some of these people that were in my story, I was like, wait, they lived that long? There's they saw no all way of those that things. Can't be.
She's straight up living in the Wild West and also experiencing World War I feels wrong, even though they're right next to each other. It's like the whole point of like Red Dead Redemption. Is that they're like their way of life is dying because it's the modern age. Anyway, so one of her businesses was called The Row, was located on Fort Smith's Waterfront Street amongst the gambling halls and saloons and other brothels. And the sign for it was a bright red star surrounded by lighted pearls. So it's just her name on the sign. Just Pearl Star. This particular brothel featured a piano player, like a hired piano player.
Fancy.
Good whiskey and, quote, the most beautiful girls west of the Mississippi. She also owned a number of saloons. She marries Arthur Erbach in 1897, though he and her newborn son die a year later from malaria, which is tragic.
Mm.
She has two illegitimate daughters, one that she had before her marriage, one that she had after her marriage. She is only ever accused of crime once, for robbing the general store in Fort Smith. And she's accused because a number of items are supposedly found in her home after the robbery. She was found guilty, but the verdict was later overturned. In 1916, Fort Smith made prostitution illegal. And for a number of years, though, they overlooked her business because, I think she was like a, like her mother, decently upstanding for someone doing illegal activity.
Well, and I bet the people who are trying to make it illegal literally went there.
Oh, absolutely.
She
was finally arrested for it, though, in 1921, and was released when she agreed just to leave the community.
Yeah.
And she dies. Like anybody does. It's not exciting. But I like that she is a very successful business owner.
Yeah.
And it all started because her stupid brother got arrested.
That's too funny.
And that's Belle Starr. One of the most notorious criminals in Arkansas history. That's how I found her. This was supposed to be about Arkansas. Again, it ended up being about Oklahoma. This happens every time I try to do something about Arkansas.
I know. Every time I'm like, oh, this would be great. And then I'm like, wait, this isn't even there.
I need to look for like the deep Ozark specific stories, like deep in the mountains. Like,
I don't think we want to know
something
what's
like
there.
That to actually do an Arkansas story, because they're never actually in Arkansas.
That was a good one.
I enjoyed it.
I like Old West stories.
I love Old West stories. They're always wild. And every time you actually tell them, you're like, oh, wait, those were just normal people doing normal things, and usually they're, like, just being prosecuted by power-hungry judges and marshals and deputies.
Some things never change. So, my story today is about the Allen House.
Ooh.
I got my information from arkansas.com, only in yourstate.com. KATV.com, AFBIC.com, and MonticelloAllenHouse.com. Located in Monticello, Arkansas, Joe Lee Allen commissioned Sylvester Hotchkiss in 1906 to design the Allen House. So Allen wanted to impress his clients because he was becoming a prominent businessman in Monticello. So he was like, let me show off how good of a businessman I am with a beautiful home.
It makes sense.
So he lived in the home with his wife, Katie, spelled C-A-D-D-Y-E.
They were, in the olden times, spelling Katie even crazier ways than people do now.
I know.
Specifically Katie.
You know, maybe it's coming back. The terribly spelled, dumb, extra letter names.
No, that's not a new thing. It's coming back
returning
around.
As a popular thing.
It goes
couldn't
like,
be me.
It's like every 100 years.
Yeah.
I read too many censuses for that not to be the case.
I know, I'm like, what is... Well, you gotta listen to these names. And their three daughters, Lonnie Lee, Liddell, known as Dell, or she went by Dell to her friends, and Louie Manker. That was her middle name, Manker.
I guess that's probably the mom's last name.
M-A-N-K-E-R.
A lot of the times, it doesn't matter if you have a boy or a girl. At some point, the maiden name of the mother gets stuck
in
there.
But why is it the middle name?
Would you rather the girl be named Manker as her first name?
I don't know. Hello, this is Editing Audrey. And in fact, the mother's last name was not Manker. It was McKinnon. So, maybe it was another family name, but I'm not really sure. So that is the only update I've got. Thank you, goodbye. Anyway, They lived there until his death in 1917. So again, another man who builds a house and doesn't live there for very long. They had a son, Walter Edwin, but he died at 9 months in 1896. I think he was their second or third. But he didn't make it. So Jolie Allen died at 54. This was just a fun fact I put in. He died at 54 in Collins, Arkansas, while quote-unquote demonstrating an automobile to a potential buyer.
What does that mean? Did he crash
That's all it said. So I was just like, so he died in a car crash?
Did they happen to have like a heart attack or a stroke?
I don't know. Like,
while driving the car?
But anyway, his friends or business partners or whatever drove his body back to, or took his body back. I don't know if they drove. Probably not after that. They probably horse and bugged him back to Monticello. And I think they had like the funeral at the house or whatever. And he's at a cemetery nearby, I'm pretty sure. Which that information's all online. I just didn't put it in because I was like, well, it's about the house and not about him. So... the house is Queen Anne Victorian style and 8,500 square feet. Jolie Allen wanted the house to be a showpiece. It's huge. It has porch columns and neoclassical design with a little bit of Gothic decoration. Another fun fact is that Jolie Allen was given the opportunity to name a new town south of Monticello because he was a significant investor. So he named it Liddell after his middle daughter.
Your tooth.
Wow. I really hope you can hear that on the recording. That's my big tooth.
Like changing it from.
Okay, so. I'm sorry if this sounds really weird, but I just inhaled water into my lungs, so I can't talk normal. But. So some sources say that. I mean, most sources said this story. Mm-hmm. Was that in 1948, Liddell Allen was recently divorced and had moved home to Monticello at the age of 45 to take care of her mother, Katie. What another source says, the one that I was telling you about, there was one source I saw that I think really did, like, a deep dive on the history and, like, fact-checked on. I mean, I don't know for sure if they did, but it really seemed like they fact-checked on, like, Ancestry.com. Did, like, a deep dive on, you know, everybody that was related to this family. And this source said that she got divorced in 1927 and was managing a hotel in Memphis. So I really don't know, but also I'll get to it at the end. So anyway, I'll tell the story as what most sources said, which also could just be the urban legend of it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so she had moved back home to take care of her mom after she had recently divorced from... what the heck was his name? It was like Robert.
It's unimportant.
Bonner. Bonner was his last name.
Okay.
That part's kind of important. So, she was back in town, and she happened to run into her high school sweetheart, Prentice Hemingway Savage.
That's an amazing name.
While he was visiting his family in town. He was married and working as an executive at Texaco Oil in Minnesota. When he returned to Minnesota, they began writing to each other regularly. They soon began a love affair. There are dozens of letters about their love affair for each other. Liddell and Savage devised a plan for him to leave his wife and run away with Liddell on Christmas. So he faked a business trip, and the two spent a two-week-long road trip from Arkansas to Minnesota, which also, like, if you're leaving your wife, why are you going back to Minnesota? I don't know. But anyway, this trip is outlined on a map that was also found underneath the floorboards of the house. Mm. So there's, I think it's still their current owner of the house, because there's an article in 2017 about the current owner, Mark and Rebecca Spencer. The article in 2017 said they bought it in like 2007 or something, but when they were renovating the house, Mark found a bunch of, like, old letters between Liddell and this guy and, like, all this stuff, outlining their love affair and whatever else. So, after months of back and forth, Savage wasn't able to leave his wife because he had, quote, a reputation to uphold. Oh, what a good man. So, that Christmas, Liddell's mother threw her annual Christmas party at the house, and everybody that was anybody was going to be there that night. So... That night, Liddell went up to her room with a glass of punch and a plate of snacks and poisoned herself with mercury cyanide.
Oh my goodness.
The next day, she was hospitalized and sent... she spent a week in the hospital before dying there on January 2nd, 1949. After this, her mother, Katie, sealed off her room for the next 37 years. It was only entered...
Liddell's room?
Yes.
And didn't lock herself in her room?
No.
Okay.
It was only entered for the first time in 1985 by one of the, like, newer... Not the current owners, but, like, another owner of the house.
Yeah.
After they had, like, bought it from whoever else. Another thing that said in the really researched article was mm-hmm. that... Liddell was a known alcoholic, not by, like, full society, but, like, by her family.
Yeah.
So they think that could have been another reason. But... so that's the story of that. Fun fact, this room is now the current master bedroom of the owners. Which it was, like, the master bedroom of the house at the time, I'm pretty sure. But, like, they're still using it as the master.
Mm-hmm.
So... Katie Allen died on July 13th, 1954. Because, like, I read that and I was like, there's no way. And she was only, like, at the age of 83. She was 83. And I'm just like, that doesn't compute in my brain.
Yeah.
But anyway, so in 1956 through 1986, the home was sectioned into apartments by Joe Lee and Katie's grandson, Dr. Carl Liedinger Jr., and was managed by Herschel Collins. The house has also served as a school apartments and a private residence. So a lot of the other articles said that, like, right after the mom died, the two remaining daughters turned it into the apartments. But in the researched one, like, one of the daughters died either before or after. One of the other two remaining daughters had either died right before or, like, right after the mom.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, okay, so then the two daughters couldn't have turned it into it. So the one, the well-researched website is the one that said this, the grandson was the one that turned it into apartments, and that seems more reasonable. Assuming they're correct that the daughter did die. But anyway... So, the current owners moved into the house in 2007, and they began renovations. They refurbished some original furniture and moved in vintage pieces to match. They unearthed artifacts from around the grounds, and they started piecing together the stories of the Allen family. Mark found over, one place says 50 letters, and one place says 90. But anyway, there's a lot of letters that they found that painted a picture of the Allen family's lives during this time, including those about Liddell's love affair and some that revealed her motive for consuming mercury cyanide on Christmas in 1948. So, both websites did say there's that she did have, like, this love affair
mm-hmm.
and whatever, but I think the urban legend is painting the picture of the recently divorced, heartbroken, going after this other man, even though... I think in actual history, she did get divorced in the 20s and not
mm-hmm.
in the 40s when she had moved in to help her mom out. So, either way, it seems like it is historically accurate that she had this love affair, and that is most likely what sent her,
mm-hmm.
as well as alcohol, into a spiral for her suicide.
That makes sense.
On Christmas. Okay, so, on to the hauntings. So soon after opening the apartments, back in the 50s, the tenants began seeing strange things and experiencing paranormal activity. Shadowy figures would appear in photographs taken by residents, their furniture would be rearranged with no one having touched anything, and objects around the house would disappear into thin air, which is one of my favorite things that ghosts mm-hmm. do, is just hiding it and then reappearing it when you don't need it anymore. So untouched rocking chairs are known to move on occasion. Their footsteps are heard in the attic, and the faint sound of a baby crying has also been heard. Don't like that. So, the story of Liddell turned into an urban legend, and the Allen House was declared haunted by both residents and locals. So, like I said, the story just seems to be a bigger mm-hmm. Urban legend, so I don't really know exactly what's completely true, but
yeah.
I'm trying to tell all sides as everything I can find. So by the 21st century, the property was under new ownership, and on June 7th, 2008, paranormal investigators were approved by owners to go, you know, around the property and everything. Mm-hmm. And it was the first quote-unquote scientific paranormal investigation of the house was supposed to be conducted on this day. But just as the team had finished setting up their equipment, a tree branch fell in the backyard and damaged some of their equipment, as well as severing the power line to the house. So the investigation had to be rescheduled. It was like another day in June that year, but yeah. Whenever they rescheduled the day for, they got over 40 EVPs that day, I think. That's a lot. Which is a lot. So, when the current owners started their renovations, they started to experience strange activity in the house. They started to see their at the time, 5-year-old son in places where he wasn't.
Like a doppelganger situation?
Yeah. It was like, and then it wasn't just him, but it was like their other kids too. So they started noticing, like, doppelganger activity in the house.
Yeah.
And, like, they didn't really think it was haunted at first. They kind of just were like, oh, this is kind of weird. And then they kind of just assumed that, like, the fumes or the mold in the house were causing them to see things. Mm-hmm. And then when it kept being weird, I think is when they had the investigators come in. Because I think it was, like, about a year that they had dealt with it. Or maybe a little under a year that they had dealt with it. And they were like, I think maybe we should see if there's something actually going on. So, one of their sons still won't use the bathroom on the first level because around, I think it was like 10 or so years ago, he heard somebody say his name there.
Yeah.
And just, like, has refused to go in there ever again. Which, like, fair enough, because I don't even care if it's a ghost, but if you need to make yourself known while I'm going to the bathroom, we're through. You can wait outside the door and be not rude. Rebecca, Mark's wife, the new owners mm-hmm. of the house, has seen a dark black outline of a man that resembles a cowboy. She calls him Shadow Man. Said she's seen his boots walk in the master bedroom, and she's seen him walk out of the front door. I think so.
Ew.
Which maybe she means like boot prints in like the carpet or something. That's worse. Or I don't know. Boots. But anyway, so she's only seen him 5 times in, like, all the time that they've lived there. And, so one of the people who have investigated the house is the Ghost Hunters crew. Mm-hmm. And they believe that they captured him on camera. So, I mean, I guess look up the Allen House episode if you want to see the Shadow Cowboy Man. So they're... have been 6 ghosts that have been identified by investigators over the years, and Liddell is one of them. Mm. So the ghosts of Jolie, Katie, Alan Bonner, who's the son of Liddell, so one of their grandsons, mm-hmm. Liddell herself, a baby, and then a man with a gruff voice have all been identified, but it's, you know, obviously likely that there are more than just those. And I wonder, because, like, their son wasn't born there, but I almost
like
wonder.
Like, who is this baby?
Yeah. But also, like, obviously other stuff went on the property before that house was there, because it was only built in 1906.
It seems like it's pretty in town.
Yeah. It's on, like, one of the main streets,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, so that means there likely was another building there at some point.
Yeah. But also it said it served as, like, a school?
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, so to this day, the Allen House is a popular hotspot for ghost hunters and historians. Guided tours are conducted by appointment. There's an old website that says it costs, like, $90 per tour with up to 6 people, and then an additional $15 per person if you want a bigger group. But then on, like, their Google thing, it says, like, it's just $15 per person, so I don't really know.
Maybe they've changed it.
So they also have special Halloween tours annually, or at least they used to.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see something scary, or what are you doing?
No.
Oh.
A hiccup.
They have also held dinner parties, and during tours and the dinner parties, guests have said that they felt like they'd been touched by an unseen force. Mm-hmm. So the house also still has a lot of the Allen family heirlooms and other items that were on display. Like, they said that, which I don't know if this was true because it's been used for so many different things, but they said that, like, the plate of snacks and, like, her punch cup that she had that night, they preserved it and stuff like that, which, like I said, I don't know if that's true, but...
But, like, if the mom locked up the room for X amount of years, but yeah, it's also entirely possible that was part of her grieving process.
The house is also a popular spot to hold weddings, that's apparently. Which I don't know if it still holds weddings since the family lives there now, but...
I think it's big enough to do both.
Yeah. But, let's see here... Oh, Carolyn Wilson's novel, The Scent of Lilacs, a romantic thriller, is set in a mansion modeled off of the Allen House. She and her husband actually lived there in 1959. That's so cool. I'm assuming when it was an apartment is when they lived there. Mm-hmm. There is also an episode of My Ghost Story about the house, as well as an episode of A Haunting, and an episode of Paranormal Witness, and an episode of Ghost Hunters. There might be a few episodes of Ghost Hunters. And there's also another book called A Haunted Love Story, The Ghosts of the Allen House by the current owner, Mark Spencer. And he also wrote a book called Ghost Walking, which I don't know if it's about the Allen House, but it might be. And that is the story of the Allen House.
I like the Allen House.
I know, I thought it was a pretty good one. I guess we're done. try not to kill anybody in Numbers with Ouija boards. Bye.